From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnairy. When Hurricane Ian swept across southwest Florida on September 28, 2022, it brought with it devastation this region had not seen for a very long time. Hurricane Irma in 2017 was severe, and in 2004 and 2005, we experienced a string of storms, Charley, Francis, Ivan, Jean, and Wilma, Charley being by far the most damaging. But even Charley did not compare to what Hurricane Ian left in its wake. It was a devastating Category 4 storm, and southwest Florida took a direct hit, with record storm surges up to 18 feet, catastrophic flooding, and immense damage exceeding $100 billion. WGCU's documentary unit produced a film earlier this year called Rising, Surviving the Surge. It's a gripping exploration of Hurricane Ian's impact and what followed as survivors worked to rise from the wreckage. It includes dramatic storm footage, powerful stories of resilience, and insights from scientists, first responders, and community leaders. Rising is meant to be a wake-up call to the new reality of storm surge. On November 13th, we screened the film at Florida Gulf Coast University's Water School, and we brought together a panel of experts from the university who had different areas of expertise to get their take on the film and have a conversation about what Ian showed us and whether we could learn any lessons and even put them into action going forward to make southwest Florida more resilient in the face of major hurricanes. Today, we're listening to the discussion that followed the film that evening. The panel featured Dr. Janine Richards. She's an assistant professor of ecology and environmental studies. Dr. Johan D. Kang. He's an associate professor of environmental economics. Dr. Shelton Weeks. He's Lucas professor of real estate and economics and finance. And Dr. Tom Felke, who's a professor of social works and executive director of FGCU's Shady Rest Institute on Aging. Let's hear that discussion now.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. I really appreciate it. That's like the fourth time I've watched it, and it still remains impactful to me. I grew up here, so the idea that we took for granted that we wouldn't have a storm like that, at least I did, because I lived here a long time. And now we know that a storm like that can happen. You know, it's like not like a theoretical thing. It's a real thing. So we have a diverse panel here in terms of backgrounds, perspectives. I would like each of you, for starters, to just tell me what you were thinking and feeling as you were watching it, both just as a person who's lived here, but, you know, from what your area of expertise is, because different people will kind of see things through a different lens. So let's start with you.
Thank you for having me here. My name is Johan. I'm sure many of you struggle to pronounce that. In fact, I started here at FGCU in the fall 2022. So I was 3 months here already and I had to go through that. So I started.
So you got here just before that.
Unfortunately. Yeah. So I'm an environmental economist, and as an environmental economist, it's my job to follow the money, right? So what the money is telling us is that risk tends to be systematically undervalued in southwest Florida. When you have people rebuilding in flood-prone areas, when you have insurance companies leaving the market, when you have billions of dollars being spent on recovery costs instead of millions of dollars in prevention, that's a market signal screaming at us. Right? The economics are pretty clear and straightforward. You know, adaptation is much cheaper than, repeated disasters. So the question then is going to be whether we are going to make that, uncomfortable decision now to avoid catastrophic costs in the future. I think that's the question we're facing here in southwest Florida.
So, Dr. Felke, you know, you come from a social services background, you know, aging population. What were you thinking when you were watching it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember sitting at home at the kitchen table because my wife actually works for the county. So she was in the emergency operations center from days before to 6 days after. And so I can clearly remember sitting at my kitchen table trying to figure out, is everything going to stay on? How are we going to coordinate this? Because I do all this mapping work, trying to map out disaster relief efforts. So watching this, I get that same sense of kind of angst about, you know, trying to, is everything going to stay on? How are we going to mobilize? How are we going to get the volunteers together? Because we went through this with Irma and we went through it with the tornado that went through Iona. And so trying to lean on that. But I also clearly remember sitting at that table the day after the storm and my wife sending me a text message from the EOC saying, we have 150 hot meals and we don't know where to send them. Where should we go? And my response being, why are you calling me? Right? You're in the EOC, right? And that immediately kind of signaled to me, we've got a problem. And we've got a problem beyond the fact of what just happened. We've got a coordination problem. And this is not going to be good.
What about you, Dr. Weeks? You know, economics, finance, real estate, where does that fit in? And how did you see that documentary? What did it bring up in you?
For me, when I watch it, I think about how completely unprepared we were for something of that magnitude. And, you know, when I think about the storm, literally in May of that year, I had given a talk to the chamber down on Fort Myers Beach about what was going on in the economy. And there was a lot of concern then about gentrification taking place as we had property values escalating very rapidly and folks being forced off the beach, in particular, the workforce being forced off. And as I look at what played out in the storm, that went from a very, really rapid process to one that was pretty much over in that it wiped everything clean and the gentrification became complete with that one storm. Now, I'm not sure how we could have been prepared, but I know as I watch it, I think we were in no way prepared for this. And as I've watched the recovery play out, that's been reinforced over and over again, because if you look at the town of Fort Myers Beach and the struggles they've gone through trying to rebuild, the scale of the devastation is just such that there's completely, it just overwhelmed them.
And as we've seen on Fort Myers Beach, because they have to rebuild to a high degree of height, as if nothing else, it went from a hard place to live to an impossible place to live if you don't have a lot of money.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that with the businesses. So if you look at Fort Myers Beach right now, we're back to the point where we have less than 40% of the businesses on Fort Myers Beach have been able to reopen. And when you look at what they have to do just for the buildings and the cost associated with building to current code, the model that we were using economically before doesn't work. They have to have greater density in order to justify the expenditure required to meet current code. And unfortunately, that's going to mean a change in the character of the town of Fort Myers Beach and many of the other places that were impacted as well.
Yeah. So Dr. Richards, ecology, environment, not necessarily economics, but I'm sure that fits in. What were you thinking when you were watching it?
So I'm probably one of the few people in this room that was not here during Hurricane Ian.
Were you out of town or just not here yet?
I was not here yet.
Oh, okay.
I was in the process of buying a house here, so that's a whole other story that I'm not going to get into. But I accepted the job here in June of 22 and was planning on moving here in December. So I watched the place that I was coming to be completely changed. And it changed my approach to being here. It changed my plan for the research that I do. I was originally most interested in working in the cypress swamps. And when I arrived after Ian, I saw the work that needed to be done on our coastlines and started, you know, stepped in a way that I could to do some of that work. So I've been on the beaches, you know, at least a couple days out of every month, measuring plants, looking at how plants are regrowing, advising people in the communities that are doing restoration on the beaches, and kind of trying to figure out we were unprepared for the restoration work that needed to happen, as well as all of the human services part of it. Nobody had thought about what do we do when our beaches are destroyed, when our mangroves are destroyed. We had no plan in place for how to address those ecological issues. And we're learning now how we do that restoration. So I think that we can be better prepared in the future for future storms. But as they were talking about at the end, as Chris Lanzi especially was talking about, as the sea level rises, that inundation with saltwater is just going to get more and more frequent. And even from the ecological perspective, even small amounts of storm surge that may not have that much effect on infrastructure will be affecting our ecological communities.
A lot of our beaches are, it takes a lot of effort, even when there isn't a hurricane, to keep those there. Is that sustainable? You know, in terms of the resilience of the things that people who come to Southwest Florida expect from a beach, not necessarily, you know, in terms of a hurricane, but a hurricane really causes a lot of grief in that whole dynamic.
Yeah. So I watched the emergency berms go in after Hurricane Ian. I watched the emergency berms erode away. I've watched the sand get washed in from Helene and Milton and then get transported back out onto the beach. And then finally, we put some plants on top of that sand, which may help to hold it in place a little bit more permanently. But yeah, there's so much investment going into the sand, moving sand around on these beaches, taking it from offshore, bringing it out from inland mines, that has all sorts of cascading impacts on, you know, the quality of our roads and what's happening in those inland mines and what's happening with the benthic life offshore where we're taking that sand from. So this is the cost of keeping this vision of these beautiful beaches going, right?
Today, we're listening to a panel discussion that followed a screening of WGCU's documentary film, Rising, Surviving the Surge, that happened at FGCU's Water School on November 13th. The voices you hear are Dr. Johan DeKang. He's an associate professor of environmental economics. Dr. Shelton Weeks. He's Lucas professor of real estate and economics and finance. And Dr. Tom Felke, who's professor of social works and executive director of FGCU's Shady Rest Institute on Aging, and Dr. Janine Richards. She's an assistant professor of ecology and environmental studies. They're all FGCU professors. You can watch Rising on WGCU's YouTube channel or find a link to it on our website for this show, wgcu.org/GCL.
So the underlying theme of our conversation is resiliency. Obviously, Ian was a storm like no other, or at least in modern times. So, you know, I don't know if, is it possible to be resilient in the face of a storm to that degree from your perspective?
Yeah, so I think that's still the best choice to make, to continuously invest in prevention, you know, because if you prevent, then you're kind of mitigating against those recovery costs. We saw after Ian that there was about over $113 billion in property damages. We saw, you know, insurance companies fleeing Southwest Florida. We've seen the premiums in Southwest Florida increasing and the valuations of the properties going down. But ultimately, I think this is probably the best way to respond, to continuously invest in those preventative measures, because for every dollar that is spent on prevention, communities are saving $6 to $13 in recovery costs. So I think that's still our best bet.
Can you give an example or two of the kinds of things that could be done in terms of preventative measures beforehand? And have any of them been done? You know, if this wouldn't be a wake-up call to whoever policymakers are responsible for making those decisions, what would make that happen?
Yeah, so I'm not an engineer, so I'm not going to answer this from an engineering point of view. Rather, from the economics point of view, I think part of the problem we have is we know about these storm surges coming, as we saw in the video. The forecast was very clear. I think it's not just about purely an engineering solution. It's also maybe the side that we don't pay a lot of attention to is the human behavior component, right? Because we knew about the storm surge coming, we saw it in the news, and yet there was still a significant number of people who did not evacuate. So we need the kind of policies that can respond to how people actually go about making decisions, right? To incentivize, to ensure that we can have more people evacuating, we can have more evacuation plans, maybe that are more efficient, something along those lines. And obviously, from the engineering point of view, it's just a case of those building codes. How can we ensure that we see more adaptation of that? Obviously, the equity issues come into play, because as the building codes improve, along with that also comes the expense, right? What about the marginalized and the poor people who can afford this? Do we have policies that can be able to make those kind of building codes accessible to everyone else? I don't know whether that answers your question.
Yeah. I was gonna skip time for you, so you read my mind.
When we look at this, first of all, the points are spot on. You know, when we look at the folks that are sort of at the margin, there are a lot of challenges there. And when you think of the experience coming out of Ian, we had about 60,000 people that were displaced following Ian just here in Lee County. And you think about the housing stock that was damaged. The majority of the damage was with older housing stock. And fortunately, we've got a couple of good programs in the state that are helping at the margin. Okay, the MySafe Florida Home, the Elevate Florida Home. The problem is the scale. When you look at the housing stock and where so much of it is located in close proximity to these low-lying areas, we really need to do a lot more. But at the margin, those programs are helpful. We shift to the newer housing stock and you look at things that are built to the current code. Those properties performed exceptionally well in the face of the storm. The things that were completed in the last 5 or 10 years, most of those properties had only cosmetic damage. And many times if they did have damage, it was because the older structure next to it was washed into it or something like that. So the code works and we're making steady progress building more resilient structures. But then we go back to the economics of it. It's very challenging. That cost factor changes dramatically when we try to build a truly resilient structure that you can put on a place like Fort Myers Beach and think it's going to make it safely through the storm.
From a real estate perspective, I mean, were you at all surprised that people continuously want to live in a place where a storm like Ian hit just a few years ago? Because obviously the demand to live where you can look at the Gulf hasn't gone away.
No, it really doesn't surprise me. You know, I think for folks that were here that have gone through the trauma of the storms, you know, if anything, I'm surprised that so many of us say, oh no, hell no, I'm staying here because I love this place, because it wears you out. You know, I mean, I was lucky to get through the storm with just minor damage at our house, you know, things that we could pay for out of pocket, a lot of inconvenience and a lot of cleanup, but it just wears you out. So if anything, I was kind of surprised that more folks didn't say, oh, heck, I'm done with this and I'm gone, especially following the storms in 24, you know, when they boom, boom, right back to back. But the demand from others to come in and live in paradise and have access to what we have here, especially when you look at the level of wealth in the country, the folks that can come here and afford to spend $500+ a square foot to build a home on their piece of paradise. No, it doesn't surprise me.
Tom, we have an older than average population in Southwest Florida, I think would be a one way to put it. Can you talk some about the challenges that presents in terms of being able to be resilient from a human services level?
Yeah, I think when we look at resilience from that perspective, obviously we look at population. And so obviously older adults, they're going to be more susceptible. We had a lot of stories coming out after Ian of older adults who were trapped in their homes, not unlike the story that comes up in the documentary. And unfortunately, with a lot of the same results. I think part of that goes to the obvious needs of the older adult. The lack of individuals wanting to evacuate was clearly an issue. And in some cases, it wasn't a lack of desire to evacuate. It was the lack of ability to evacuate. A lot of our older adults do not have the types of resources around them. They don't have the family around them to make those kind of trips. We also, when we look at the resiliency piece, I wanted to touch back on that for a second because, you know, I spent 18 months on the Resiliently piece that Commissioner Ruane put together afterwards. And I sat in these meetings and we talked a lot about building codes and economics and infrastructure and those pieces. And very little did we ever hear things about the social services side of things, which I think is critically important to that resilience piece. If people are not familiar, we live in a healthcare desert by and large. And one of the biggest places we see that is with mental health. You know, we have 900 residents on average for every one mental health professional across Southwest Florida. So when you talk about the trauma after the storms and you look at that piece in terms of the recovery effort, our investment needs to be broad and wide, right? It needs to be in looking at changing building code and how we're bringing pieces up, how we're looking at our environmental aspects so that we don't have as severe flooding. We have to look at it from an economic perspective, but we also can't forget that there's a human component in all of this that underlies everything else that we're talking about in this regard.
Dr. Richards, you're fairly new to the community, so you see it with sort of fresher eyes. Like what, besides the coast, because you can do certain things to the coast to make it absorb energy with a storm coming ashore. But when you look at our, you know, four county region, you know, are there things that you think could be done that you might say were the lowest hanging fruit, or has the way we have built and, you know, evolved over the past 80 years put us in a position where that makes it extremely difficult?
I think both things are true. I think that the way that we've built has made things very difficult. I think that we've degraded a lot of our natural systems that would offer to us some protection already. So along the coast, we've pretty much built on top of the natural dune system that would provide some protection against that incoming surge. On the backside, we've cut down a lot of the mangroves to make room for more development. The mangroves would absorb some of that floodwater coming in from the backside. Along the rivers also, we're building right along the rivers, and some of that natural floodplain is no longer there to absorb water for us. It's going into homes instead. So all of that is true, but I do think that we have a lot of opportunities in terms of restoration of these natural systems that would give us some buffer and some additional ecosystem services from doing what we term nature-based solutions, or kind of working with the natural resilience of nature to these kinds of events to help protect our human communities.
Is it possible to plant mangroves in places where we expect there to be problems somewhat over the horizon, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I talk about with some of my colleagues a lot is, you know, the natural distribution of some of these ecosystems is shifting as sea level rises and as climate warms. And so we have to think ahead. We have to not only be migrating our human communities in some cases, but thinking about how we help to migrate our natural communities so that they can persist and continue to protect us.
If you just tuned in, we're listening to a panel discussion we hosted following a screening of Rising, Surviving the Surge. It's a film by WGCU's documentary unit that came out earlier this year. It's a gripping exploration of Hurricane Ian's impact and what followed as survivors work to rise from the wreckage. It includes dramatic storm footage, powerful stories of resilience, and insights from scientists, first responders, and community leaders. I was joined on the panel by Dr. Johan Dekang. He's an associate professor of environmental economics. Dr. Shelton Weeks. He's Lucas Professor of Real Estate and Economics and Finance. Dr. Tom Felke, who's a professor of social works and executive director of the Shady Rest Institute on Aging. And Dr. Janine Richards, she's an assistant professor of ecology and environmental studies, all at FGCU. You can watch Rising on WGCU's YouTube channel or find a link to it on our website, wgcu.org/GCL.
Other than raising all of our houses. No, I'm, you know, it's a rock and a hard place. It's kind of like affordable housing. It's like a house is worth what the market will bear. So if you're going to sell it for less, you have to figure out somebody who's going to pick up that other thing. You know, we've seen with that storm with Ian, you know, that's probably hopefully the worst case scenario. We've only got 17 more days, by the way, until hurricane season ends this year. Knock on wood. But, you know, from a environmental economics perspective, you know, we can do things to try to have, like you talked about, the human, you know, mentality part of it. But is there a way to, I guess the big question is there a way to live in this part of the world and not just to have those sorts of things happen occasionally and suffer the consequences for it?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we need to find a balance between sort of nature-based solutions, which I think there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to that. I think we figure that we would sort of always find an engineering solution to this. I think it doesn't matter how many hard structures we put out there. We have to maybe rethink in terms of paying attention also to nature-based solutions, things like mangroves, how they can slow this storm surges and things like that. And I think we also need to do a better job in terms of assessing whether all these evacuation plans and things work, because we are just assumed that these things work, right? We have to evaluate whether these evacuation plans and all these things we have in place, how did they fare against Hurricane Ian and other hurricanes, so that if there's room for improvement, we need to, you know, be able to improve them accordingly. And then I think one of the things, so I'm working on a couple of projects where we are looking at the impacts of hurricanes on migration, on labor, how it affects economic activities. We're looking at restoration efforts, for example. We've seen in Naples, Collier County, and Lee County, where we would have, you know, Hurricane Ian and other similar hurricanes, we see the beaches being, the sand being wiped out. You see trucks and after trucks coming in, delivering all these sand and millions of dollars being spent on this. A few months later, all that is gone, right? So I think we need to rethink more effective way and find a solution, or rather a balance between engineering and nature-based. And I think that would go a long way.
Tom, I know you're a data guy. I know you're a mapping guy. Did we learn, or did you learn anything from this storm? I mean, did it teach us anything that we didn't know about which populations were at most risk for this kind of thing, or surprises where we didn't think that area would be at risk?
Yeah, first I want to say Shelton and I did affordable housing last week. So if you're interested in that panel, you can go check that out. but what did we learn? I don't know how much the data taught us that we didn't know about as much as the experiences taught us. The fact that our human service nonprofit government connection was so absolutely weak to the point that we had no connection between counties, right? That was a major problem. I think part of that you see in the documentary. I think we may have skipped that one part with the phone call that goes into, you know, the dispatch and the woman saying, we have nobody out there and we can't do anything. We know that when that hit Lee County, it shut down Lee County's call center and they had to route Lee County calls to Collier County. And so now you've got dispatch operators in Collier County taking calls from people in Lee County saying, I think I'm about to drown, right? And the impact that that puts on that type of a situation. So I think the big thing that we learned didn't have anything to do with data or maps or anything like that. What it had to do with was the fact that in the reality of these situations, we were so woefully underprepared for a community that we talk all the time that it's not if, it's when, right? And we know that's going to be the case again. So I think what we learned is we have a lot more to learn, right? We have a lot more we have to put in place. We have to do better at coordination. We have to be better at communication. Our responses need to be better targeted. If there's one thing that I take as a silver lining out of this documentary, from not a personal point of pride, but as a university and a program point of pride, is I watch that video and I sit there and I go, that's an alum, that's an alum, that's an alum. And I can pick these people off and know that these are individuals that have been through it. They've been properly trained and they are taking these roles now because they don't want this to be the situation that they went through and that they experienced, both as students and professionals, and they want it to be a better situation moving forward.
Dr. Weeks, is there our economy, you know, tourism, service economy, agriculture, ranching, those are the kind of the main things. Does that make us particularly susceptible, you know, to both in terms of what we experience during a storm, but more importantly, how we are able or have the people to help rebuild afterwards?
Well, when you think about the labor market and what happened in the wake of Ian, a lot of our folks that were in the service industry were directly impacted. A lot of the folks that were in the construction industry, the folks that we needed to help us recover, put the pieces back together, many of them lost their homes. So I think when you look at the composition of the workforce here, realize that they're the ones that are most likely to be in some of that older substandard housing stock. I think it does put us at greater risk. And again, makes the programs like My Safe Florida Home or Elevate Florida that much more appropriate. But we got to figure out a way to cover the masses here, because those are the folks we need in the immediate wake of the storm to get the pieces put back together.
Dr. Mike Martin, President Emeritus now, he told me he was on a, and you may have been even involved, it was some sort of post-Ian economic thing. And he said that the labor participation rate in Southwest Florida or Lee County is like 50%, meaning like one out of two people you see driving down the road is retired or not working. And he said that was creating a huge challenge. Even if you had the resources to find people to rebuild, finding people was a problem.
Yeah, when you look at the composition of the population, when we attract a lot of wealthy retirees here, they require a large quantity of services of every type. So as a result, they're not in the workforce. Instead, they're here consuming a lot of those services. So that makes our ability to respond to things like this a bit more challenging.
Mike, real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's a great point. And I think another piece that did come from the panel that we had, you know, we had one of the Collier County growth management people that has talked about the fact that 63,000, I think they said.
Yes.
Individuals commute into Collier County on a daily basis for work. Mm-hmm. Right. So now you think about that aspect that, when that hits Lee County and that's affecting that population is not going into Collier, right, for that workforce piece. So then you've got that extra limitation on top of everything else. And then the inability for those businesses to be able to help their employees who are now outside of that. So you've got this very odd dynamic in that way that does come back to the partly that affordable housing piece of people not being able to afford to live where they work.
Dr. Richards, I did a show a few years ago on a living shorelines project up in the armpit. I guess I don't know if that's what you call it. The
tell them they're calling.
Yeah, the big bend region, I think they call it. But it was several years into the study. They got hit almost directly by a hurricane. It showed a significant ability to withstand the storm damage, but I don't think that was being built on an area like our coast, which is where people live. You know, because of the way we are on our coast and because of the beaches, does that just make it inherently harder, if not impossible, to create a proper living shoreline that is sort of designed to withstand storms? that an answerable question?
Yeah, I think so. So one of the characteristics of our shoreline here that I don't think they really have in the Big Bend region is our barrier islands. And a lot of our development is on our barrier islands. So a barrier island is sand. It's not meant to stay in one place. It's meant to shift around and move over time. And that's not compatible with our human development that we have on our barrier islands. So these are systems that would naturally be moving and shifting, and we've put buildings on top of them to prevent them and are actively working to prevent them from moving and shifting, resculpting our shorelines, our beaches, bringing in sand from other places. But I do think that there are opportunities still there to reinforce some of the natural systems that still exist on those islands and would have historically existed on those islands. Mangroves are particularly important, and we can do mangrove restoration. Mm-hmm. We've got sort of a continuum, right? So we've got offshore, we need the seagrasses and the oyster beds that diminish the wave force as it's first coming in. On the coastline, we need the dune system, and ideally we would have a series of several dunes. The place that we really have a good example of that is on Sanibel. Whereas on the rest of the coast, we've built much closer to the ocean front. But I think there are places where we can start to put into place some of those. And as Johanny mentioned before, maybe combining that with some engineered solutions is where we need to head in the longer term.
If money was no object, what, I'm going to go back to you, Johanny, what could we do if money was no object? And then I want to ask, like, what is the object, or what is prohibiting us from doing it? I know that's none of us really know the answer to that exactly, but if money was no object, like, how could we make this community from Charlotte County to Naples as resilient as possible in the face of a storm like Ian?
Yeah, so I think the simple answer here would be to all the old sort of inventory that's already there in terms of housing, to obviously get them up to code. Because as I think Shelton mentioned earlier, you know, the building codes, the newer codes, they're performing much better, right? And then you could have programs where, you know, certain obvious areas people could be kind of prohibited from moving into those areas, maybe relocate, because relocating people also costs money, right? Where you could buy back, you could have the state buying back some land, and say in some places it's not really a good place for people to live there, no matter how much money you throw at it. And obviously you need to compensate people for that, and to continuously evaluate how the various sort of emergency and evacuation initiatives or programs are performing. Because I don't know how old are these evacuation plans and things like that. People take it as given that simply by implementing them, things will work, right? And maybe put more resources to also understanding the human behavior aspect, to understand what would it take to make people to kind of respond during emergencies to things like evacuation and enhance the evacuation plans and things like that. So I think that those would be the places, if money wasn't an issue, where obvious places to kind of invest in those areas.
How much did you say the economic impact from Ian was? You said it's
$113 billion in Florida. Then in Southwest Florida, having insurance companies moving out, having paying more for flood insurance, but your value of your property is going down. Surely you can see how this doesn't make a lot of sense. So those are the challenges, and having the, you know, low income people, you know, affected in this way in such a manner that they can't be able to go to work. They don't have, how many people don't have flood insurance, for example? What happens to these people after you have disasters? Because if you don't have insurance, you don't have, or you are poor, lower income, you don't have the luxury to evacuate. You don't have the luxury to relocate somewhere. You have no payout from any insurance. Your life is ruined, right? So those would be the kind of places to really invest in.
is there a point at which, and this might be for you, Dr. Weeks, or anybody, I mean, is there a point at which it becomes, we become uninsurable in certain areas in Southwest Florida?
Yeah, I think so. You know, at some point when you look at certain risk, they're just not worth assuming. And when you, and I hate to throw FEMA out there as an example of being right, because, you know, I apologize if anybody hears from FEMA, but they get plenty wrong. And when you look at their policies associated with, say, the FEMA 50% rule and the way they deal with special flood hazard areas and repetitive loss structures, one of their goals, the overriding goals with those policies, is to make sure that we don't continue to build back in areas where you're just going to have loss after loss after loss.
Explain the 50% rule and just a real quickly for people who don't.
The Reader's Digest version of that, for the people old enough to know what Reader's Digest version is. So when you look at the FEMA 50% rule, basically what it says is that in order for a community to be able to participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, they have to have a floodplain management program in place. 50% rule is how they operationalize that. If you have a structure that's located in a special flood hazard area and it has damage that exceeds 50% of the depreciated value of the structure prior to the event, then it has to be brought completely up to code. So for most structures, that would mean they'd have to be torn down and rebuilt.
Tom, from your perspective, if money was no object, what would you wave your magic wand and
What I think I'd like to see is something that we talked about during that Resilient Lee task force that we participated in, which is resiliency hubs. This is something we don't have a lot of in our community. The idea behind a resiliency hub is that it is a known entity in your community that can be utilized in blue sky and gray sky days, right? So the blue sky days, it's providing services, it's, you know, providing education in the community. And then gray skies during, after disasters, individuals know that facility from the blue sky days to go back there to get that support. We talked a lot about resiliency hubs when we were going through the Resilient Lee task force. I think United Way, Jeannie Joy, is actually taking that initiative on. But one of the things that we quickly identified was we don't have a lot of really great places to serve as those locations, right? We talk a lot about older adults. There are 5 senior centers in Southwest Florida, right? And by Southwest Florida there, I'm saying Collier and Lee County. That's it, 5, right? So, and they are not equipped to handle something like this. After Hurricane Ian and after the tornadoes in Iona, we set up what we called a MARC, a multi-agency resource center, which was the idea that Shelton came up, hit on here with. We started with Lee County employees and getting them serviced and making sure that they were there, because we knew those were the individuals we needed back out on the streets to help with the recovery efforts. So we started with them, brought the agencies in. But when we did that after the tornado, and we had to set up in a gym in a school, in a middle school. After Ian, we were on the 3rd floor of a non-used building. It wasn't very accessible. So we don't have a lot of that. I wish our Lee County and Collier County commissioners would go up to Charlotte County and get a look at what's up there called the Family Support Center. That is basically a MARC every single day, right? That's what it's designed for. It's designed to support the community. It is well situated in the center of a community, so it's very easily accessible. So that's what I think we need. We need more focus on those types of locations so that people know where to go in the event of that disaster and where they can get proper services.
We're listening to a panel discussion that followed a screening of WGCU's documentary film called Rising, Surviving the Surge. It happened at FGCU's Water School on November 13th of this year. The voices you hear are Dr. Johan D. Kang. He's an associate professor of environmental economics at FGCU. Dr. Shelton Weeks is Lucas Professor of Real Estate and Economics and Finance at FGCU. Dr. Tom Felke is Professor of Social Works and Executive Director of FGCU's Shady Rest Institute on Positive Aging. Dr. Janine Richards is Assistant Professor of Ecology and Environmental Studies. You can watch Rising on WGCU's YouTube channel or find a link to it on our website, wgcu.org/GCL.
We, after Ian, every year since that, right before the beginning of the hurricane season at WGCU, we've made it a thing we're going to do from now on. We call it a Blue Sky Summit. We bring in emergency management people from all of our counties. We get around a huge table, and we all try to get to know each other, because building those human relationships beforehand makes it so much more important. And while I'm at it, one of the great things, if you could say there was a great thing about Ian, was the help that every human gave every other human in a time and place in this country where there's a lot of partisanship. And you didn't see that after Ian. So, you know, if there's a lesson we can learn, it's maybe that.
And I agree. You know, one of the benefits for us, one of the silver linings looking at older adults, was we hosted a older adult emergency management summit here in this building by bringing together all of those organizations. Because, you know, the thing was, when I'm saying, you know, we were woefully underprepared, that's just not me saying that. That was the nonprofits looking at each other and being honest with themselves and going, man, we did not do a great job here, right? Showing up at the same locations with the same exact services and not coordinating that, and then getting on site and then kind of point, well, no, you do it. Well, no, you do. Well, we were here first. No. There's a whole nother community over there that needs help. Somebody just pack up and go. Right? That's the type of thing that we need. We need that level of leadership. And I think you're right, Mike, by getting groups together, having those conversations, being honest about what the performance was so we don't repeat that in the future is part of the important piece.
Shelton, I'm going to give you the, I don't know if it's fair to ask you as an economist, but, you know, if money was no object, what could we do to make us as safe as possible in the face of a storm like that?
I think that I would have mandatory inspections and require folks to have a minimum level of safety for structures before you CO'd them. So bring everything up to as close to the current standard as you possibly could and have those inspected so that folks have absolute confidence in the structure that they're going to try to shelter in. Because when you look at older housing stock, there's so many issues there that I would try to make that the number one priority.
Okay, what about you, Dr. Richards? You know, if you had a magic wand and you could create some sort of systems, whether along the coast or inland, the way we move water around, things like that, like what would be the best thing we could do to, you know, make the impact as minimal as possible on us humans?
I think that is some of these most vulnerable locations, like they talked in the film there, somebody said that we're going to get to a point where we can't mitigate the problem away in some locations. And we're going to get closer and closer to that in various places. And some places are more vulnerable than others in terms of damage that they will incur from these storms. So what I would like to see, what my magic wand vision would be, is turning some of those places proactively back to nature. And that would, of course, involve buying out land on a large scale and getting people to relocate, which is probably not a realistic vision. But I think that that would give us space to build back some of that natural infrastructure that would provide better protection for the human infrastructure that we do decide we can mitigate and keep.
I can just jump in on that. When you look at that, no, it's probably not realistic from an economic standpoint to do that on a large scale, but I think it has to be part of the answer.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at some of these places where you've got the extreme bowling effects and stuff like that, really close to the coast, we're going to get to the point
where it doesn't make sense to keep throwing money into those communities very quickly. And the best thing to do will be to help get those folks into a safe location and safe structures.
You know, Hurricane Charley was 2004, and it wasn't till, you know, it was almost from Charley to Ian where we had an event that was that serious, and it makes people complacent. You forget. Obviously, I joked we only have 17 days of hurricane season left, and it would be great to make it through the entire season without an event. But, you know, each year that goes by without one is to just make it harder. Do we have to strike while the memory is recent, I guess, in terms of like taking action?
Absolutely. We're human beings. We forget things, you know, that memory fades. And next thing you know, somebody's staying when they need to go. And I can tell you, my wife and I stayed at home for Helene and realized at about 8 o'clock that night that we should have left. Went outside to walk the dog, and we had a foot and a half of water in the street in front of the house. We both drive Hondas. There's no way we're getting out of there now. So that was a very long night, and Ian wasn't that long ago.
Does anybody have any questions in the audience?
We did take questions that evening, but they were not on mics or barely discernible in the recording, so I'll summarize them going forward so we can hear the answers. Question one was, Dr. Felke, does anything like what we have locally when it comes to government and nonprofit partnerships exist on a larger, even national scale that could be mobilized here?
Yeah, that'd be great. No, we're getting better, right? I don't want it to be a complete negative. We're getting better. I just don't think we're there yet. We're still trying to figure out exactly what we need, right? You saw Katie Eck, who's leading the unmet need long-term recovery group. That's still going, right? I'm part of that group too. And so we still have a lot of work to do from there. And so while we are still trying to figure out what do we do when the next one of these things comes, we're also still trying to figure out how to recover from where we are. And so we just don't have the mechanisms right now to be at that level. So we are trying to learn as much as we can. We are trying to get better at the coordination. I've seen improvements in both Collier and Lee County. I think Lee County putting together their Ready Lee app, I think is going to be an improvement over some of the communications issues that we had in the past, but there's still a lot we need to learn and that we need to bring together. I'm a big fan of not reinventing the wheel. The idea of the resiliency hub is a national idea. So I was glad to see that come here, but we haven't fully realized it. So again, we still have a little way to go.
Yeah. And maybe to that point, I think, you know, we probably also need plans beyond just the counties individually. You need a plan from all, let's say, if we're just to focus on Southwest Florida, probably all the counties getting together and having a plan. And in that plan, having scenarios, contingencies, where if communications are down in one county, how does one kick in, right? So I think that would be one of what's required to improve things in the future.
The next question was, while it might be impractical to move people out of areas that are most at risk, maybe one thing we could do is identify places where we should not build in the future. Do you think we have the political will, and or what levers do we have to influence decisions in order to do that?
Yeah, I think that's why it would be important to kind of be proactive. Maybe this is something we need to do in the academic environment. Maybe undertake some studies where we could show what the benefit cost analysis looks like, you know, where you invest in preventing people from moving there versus what the cost would be if people were to move there. I think those are some of the things, the kind of insight that we need to generate, that kind of knowledge, and share it with the policymakers. Because at the end of the day, it's a benefit cost. If you don't show them what's the cost and what's the benefit, the developers are always going to win in terms of every place is not going to be out of reach for them, right? So that's probably something we have to do on the academic side.
I think to go along with that, to the extent that we can come up with policies where we can incentivize property owners, if they're going to add to the structures or developments they've got in a given area, to do it in a manner that's going to make it less susceptible to flooding or to wind. I think that's really important. I mean, one of the few things we can bank on in economics is that incentives work. And if we can come up with the right incentive structure, then there's going to be a lot of value associated with that. When you think about the political will to make hard decisions to stop the path of development, as a real estate guy, I want to tell you that's probably, you know, that's a big ask. But I think at the individual level, if we can come up with the right incentives, we can really shape behavior and hopefully get a lot better outcomes.
Question three was, why did we have so many storms in recent years and then none this year?
I'll give you the statistical answers. They're statistically independent events, you know. So the fact that you get hit one year and maybe multiple times in a year, it really has nothing to do with what's going to happen the following year. So you go back to what our meteorologist, Matt Devin, was saying. You just can't base it on what happens with those other storms because there's so many factors that steer the storms and things like that. Some years we're going to get lucky. Other years, oh, look out.
And finally, the last person asked, what were the things we learned big picture from Hurricane Ian?
I think there are always lessons to be learned when you have situations like that. You know, I know the folks in the building industry are always looking at the experience with different techniques and different materials when you have wind and rain events. And that technology continues to get better as a result of that. But we've always got to learn from what's happening somewhere else, whether it's here in Florida or somewhere else in the U.S. or around the world.
We need to figure out a way to change our culture so we look out into the distant future.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. As human beings, we tend to discount, you know, the $5,000 that you have to spend now on hurricane-proof windows or shutters is something that we dread as compared to losing out $500,000 loss on a property. So that's one of the challenges. And that's one of the things that we also need to do a better job of seeing how to kind of incentivize so that we can make better choices away from always those kind of default choices that as human beings, we tend to just, you know, behave in that way.
That was a panel discussion we hosted at Florida Gulf Coast University's Water School on November 13th of this year, following a screening of WGCU's documentary film, Rising, Surviving the Surge. The panelists were Dr. Johan D. Kang, Associate Professor of Environmental Economics at Florida Gulf Coast University, Dr. Shelton Weeks, Lucas Professor of Real Estate and Economics and Finance at FGCU, Dr. Tom Felke, Professor of Social Works and Executive Director of the Shady Rest Institute on Positive Aging, and Dr. Janine Richards, Assistant Professor of Ecology and Environmental Studies. She and Dr. Felke are both at FGCU. You can watch the film on WGCU's YouTube channel, or we'll have a link to it on the web post for this episode at wgcu.org/GCL. Our show today was produced by yours truly, the members of WGCU's documentary unit who made Rising, Surviving the Surge, are Janine Zeitlin. She's senior producer and writer, and Tom James. He was videographer and editor. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.